right, we are back. I want to continue with the current events on this segment because there is just so much stuff going on out there in the new year. The first thing that really hits me between the eyes, picking up on something we mentioned last week, George W. Bush went out and got himself a smallpox vaccination. And he's basically pushing very hard to have the health providers in this nation go out and receive smallpox vaccinations. Now, we're going to get into this in some depth in a future show, but I just want to say today that, you know, there is no credible evidence I've seen that Iraq or anyone else possesses smallpox. And it's difficult to envision it being turned loose on the world because once you let smallpox, the genie out of the bottle once again, everybody on Earth is going to be vulnerable. Now, presumably anyone that would want to harm America must have some group that they are, you know, fond of, they would like to see flourish. And the idea that this weapon, once unleashed, would come back and bite virtually anybody on Earth must give certainly any government pause. I mean, not to say there's not some crazy lunatic apocalyptic group like those people in Japan that let loose the sarin gas on the subway. I mean, those kind of people you do have to worry about. But we're talking about Iraq and the fact that we're all presumably going to need to be immunized for smallpox. I don't get this. I don't get this. Story off the web. Washington Post reports December 18th, two prominent teaching hospitals are refusing to vaccinate their employees against smallpox, even though their staffs would be among the first responders in the event of a biological attack. In Israel as well, there's some staff in Tel Aviv Hospital have refused to take the smallpox vaccine being offered by the government. Now, earlier this year, President Bush signed a bioterrorism response bill providing huge windfall profits for pharmaceutical companies. And the recently passed Homeland Security bill provides immunity for vaccine makers in the event that recipients of vaccines become ill or die after being vaccinated. Under current Food and Drug Administration regulations, smallpox vaccines do not have to be certified for efficacy prior to being introduced into the general population. There's a lot of things about this that are worrisome. The first thing that I would cite is the fact that with these complex series of regulations that are going into effect, the government may make refusing to get a vaccination a crime, punishable by incarceration, which would also permit forced vaccinations in declared health emergencies. Now, the first rule in medicine is do no harm. Now, almost every vaccine has, in certain small percentage of cases, the possibility of an adverse outcome. Anytime you introduce some sort of foreign substance into the body, there's always that possibility. I mean, penicillin is a wonderful drug, but one person in 50,000 may have a very bad reaction to it. We basically have taken aspirin away from pediatric patients because one person, again, and perhaps 50,000, may get a serious condition called Reye's syndrome. Well, a lot of us took aspirin in the other 49,999, and it did a lot of good. Now, before you implement something this kind of a huge project, I think you better have better evidence that there really is a threat from smallpox. Related story, vaccine costs to hit local budgets. Now, this program is being pushed very hard by the federal government, and local health people have estimated from all across the country that the $940 million that Congress allocated for this has been spent for steps to respond to the anthrax supposed threats. And we should reiterate, the anthrax that was used in the attacks on the government was domestic anthrax produced by you and me, the taxpayer. We funded it being its production at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and other places. We were attacked by domestic anthrax. But if we're going to do something about smallpox, how are we going to fund this sort of thing? To do this, we're going to have to take money out of meaningful health programs and put them into this will-o'-the-wisp threat. Deal with this potential threat of smallpox. Again, we need more data. We're going to get into this in some more detail in future shows. Another related story about the smallpox vaccination. Sales of vaccines are booming. Global revenue is set to reach $10 billion in 2006 from $5 billion in 2001. In the wake of the September 11th attacks, the U.S. has spawned a new business in supplying vaccines against smallpox, growing following fears the deadly virus might be used as a weapon. Well, what can you say? Now, we talked about Senator Bill Frist, the only doctor in the U.S. Senate, who has, of course, taken Trent Lott's place. Frist is a favorite of the Bush administration. We said we'd have a little more data on him for this show, and I have a couple more facts of interest about Senator Frist. Columbia HCA, the company that his family founded, is the world's largest private hospital company. Article I saved here from the Bee, dated 11/29/02, before Frist took over for Trent Lott. Vaccine law is a DC whodunit. No one will admit slipping lawsuit protection for Eli Lilly into the Homeland Security bill, from the New York Times' Sherry Gay Stolberg. Lobbyists for Eli Lilly, the pharmaceutical giant, did not have much luck when they made the rounds of Capitol Hill earlier this year, seeking protection from lawsuits over a preservative in vaccines. Senator Bill Frist, Republican Tennessee, tucked a provision into a bill that went nowhere. But when this Homeland Security bill got hammered out some months later, all of a sudden, the same bill magically reappeared. One aide said the language mysteriously appeared in the House version of the bill in different type from the rest of the measure, as though someone had clipped it out of Frist's legislation and simply pasted it in. Now, interestingly, the White House has close ties to Eli Lilly. The elder George Bush sat on Lilly's board in the late 70s. The White House budget director Mitch Daniels is a former Lilly executive. Of course, Rob Smith, a spokesman for Lilly, says the company's lobbyists made absolutely no contact with Mitch or anyone in his office about this. This is the part I like. Quote, "It's a mystery to us how it got there," Smith said of the provision. Let's just talk some more politics. The GOP, now for the first time since the Herbert Hoover administration, has a Republican in the White House and appears to have control of both houses of Congress. Are they going to do tax reform? This has supposedly been near and dear to the Republican hearts for some time. And truthfully, I think that America is in need of quite a bit of tax reform. We'll see whether they endorse some ideas like the flat tax. Well, now that they're in charge, this flat tax they were so charged up about some while back, many Republican candidates were very interested in it. They've gotten very quiet about this. It seems like it would benefit a lot of us if to have a flat tax that was lower than the current tax rate. I believe that since we're not pushing it, that the big fat cats in the GOP and the Democrats, too, are happy with the current tax situation and do not want to see any sort of change. Now, Bush is talking about cutting taxes on corporate dividends. And I didn't realize this, but apparently when corporations release dividends, the government steps right in, takes a big cut. Then when you get the dividend, they step in and take another cut. So something like 60% of the original dividend goes to taxes. Now, the Democrats are not excited about this issue, and I think they're they better wake up and smell the coffee. There's an awful lot of stockholders in this country, and they would like a little bit of, you know, tax relief. We're also in a future show going to talk about the fact that the inheritance tax has been reduced, and gets reduced to basically by the year 2009, you can inherit, it'll go up to something like $3 million the year before, and after that, you can inherit $10, $20 million. Now, there's only a small percentage of people who are in this boat, admittedly, in the country. But if nothing is done about it, in the year 2010, you can go from the stroke of midnight, inherit $10 million from mom who's sick and in the hospital, to the next day having a tax bill of, well, perhaps over half the money could well go to Uncle Sam. Now, you think there's going to be a lot of interesting discussions over like a life support come December 2009 if there's not some reform instituted in the meantime. Barbara Boxer and the Democrats were not, and I guess Dianne Feinstein both voted against that. That's one I don't really have a beef with the GOP over. I'd like to see some tax relief for all of us. You know, I don't really believe necessarily that they are our friends and want to really revise our budget. The Republicans ran against deficit spending. It was Ronald Reagan's mantra running in the 70s. Deficit spending was the great evil of the federal government. It was living too well, high on the hog, spending more than it took in. How long could that go on? But 2 years into the Reagan administration, I remember when David Stockman, touted as the boy genius, the man who understood all the numbers, the Reagan White House, Office of the OMB, Office of Management and Budget, I guess it is. He admitted that 2 years into the Reagan White House, they were going to have budget deficits of $180 million. And within a year or two, the budget deficits totaled greater than all of the budget deficits of all the budgets dating back to George Washington. The Republicans suddenly decided they weren't that down on deficit spending. And they're right now saying they're not that down on it again. I'm not an economist, but I kind of agreed with the original Reagan idea, I think, to some degree, that if you keep spending more than you take in, well, you just can't keep doing that indefinitely. So anyway, I do wish them well on tax reform. We're going to follow that issue. And one that I'm going to have a very special interview in the weeks to come on is an issue I'm very much at odds with the GOP on. The 30th anniversary of Roe versus Wade comes up about later this month, I believe on the 22nd. We're going to talk about this on next week's show. Basically, this country supports abortion rights by a fairly substantial margin. And the GOP downplays the fact that it's going to repeal Roe versus Wade to appeal to most of such people. The Christian right, of course, is very excited at the prospect of overturning it and making abortion illegal again, as it was in so many states before 1972. And the target they have in the crosshairs, for starters, is the partial birth abortion, which you've heard a great deal about. Bill Frist, by the way, the only doctor in the Senate, is considered a strong ally by the National Right to Life Committee, which has given him 100% rating on major votes in the past 6 years. Ken Connor, president of the Conservative Family Research Council, was quoted in the Bee as saying that Frist may be particularly effective for the anti-abortion case because of his background as a surgeon. This may come as news to Mr. Ken Connor. Frist is a thoracic surgeon. Babies and reproduction, it doesn't take place inside the chest cavity. It goes on somewhere else. Now, they did pass a ban on this procedure, the partial birth abortion. Several states did. It was overturned by the Supreme Court by a narrow 5-4 margin. Apparently, Sandra Day O'Connor is just not quite able to join the felonious four and go along with this issue, which is to her credit. I should also mention, I don't think I should be overly shy about pointing out the fact that Tony Kennedy basically sided against overturning this law when it was before it last year on various unconstitutional aspects. He's siding with Rehnquist, Antonin Scalia, and Clarence Uncle Thomas on this one. Now, these four plus Sandra Day O'Connor were, of course, the people that, legal rulings be damned. We're just going to stop the vote count in Florida. And I don't know. I'm glad that O'Connor's still there. This offers some protection for seeing this overturned by the court. But back to the issue of the partial birth abortion. You've heard a lot about it. Well, there seems to be a lot of support for eliminating this procedure. It's portrayed as a barbarity that basically you deliver, the fetus in portions. Well, I don't want to go into the details today. But I do want to tell you that I know someone who had to go out and seek a partial birth abortion. He's a physician. His wife is a registered nurse. They had a fetus that was not going to live. I'm going to basically have this person come on the show, I think, in the weeks to come and tell his story much more eloquently than I possibly can about what it meant to him and how glad he was that for the safety and protection of his wife, they were still able to get this procedure. Really a heartbreak of a story in many respects. We are flat out of time. I am Douglas Everett, and this was Radio Parallax. You've been listening to KDVS 90.3 FM, and we hope you will stay listening and that you will tune in again next Thursday at 5 o'clock. We'll see you.